This is a full day one for California's new governor and the plans that he laid out in his inaugural address. On Insight, we'll get reaction to the governor's direction with respect to housing and homelessness, early childhood education, and LGBT rights. In the studio with me will be representatives from agencies that work with people in each of those arenas. Then Ben Adler's conversation with the former governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. They talked at yesterday's inauguration. And you'll hear more from my conversation with another former governor, Gray Davis. He and I talked about California's wildfires, which destroyed the homes of two of his family members, and emergency response is on the agenda of the new governor today. At the end of the hour, reporter Pauline Bartolone with stories from the campfire. She talked with people who suffered great losses but plan to stay. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Gavin Newsom is now officially California's 40th governor, and so the watch begins. How, in fact, will he follow through on promises that he made during the campaign and yesterday in the inaugural speech? Advocates for early childhood development, for housing and homelessness policy, and the LGBTQ community are joining me because these are three arenas that are getting focus from the new governor, arenas that he has promised will get some attention. Samantha Tran is Senior Managing Director for Education Policy with the organization Children Now. She's been with us before. Hi, Samantha.
Hi.
Glad to have you back.
Yeah, thanks so much.
David Heitzeman is Executive Director of the Sacramento LGBT Community Center. I'm glad to have David in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
And joining us by phone is Kathy Creswell, Board President of the Sacramento Housing Alliance. Hi, Kathy. Glad to have you in the conversation, too.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What was so compelling is that this is a governor coming into this job as a married father of four, and his little two, almost three-year-old son, Dutch, kind of stole the show yesterday, but emphasized the point that this is going to be an administration with children on the mind. Samantha, how did the whole speech play for you and that interaction so vividly of his family?
Yeah, it was excellent. The fact that kids were at the forefront at every turn, it was pretty clear that this governor, I mean, on the campaign trail and clearly in the speech, was lifting up children and a focus on this next generation. I mean, we're really hopeful that he's going to be a kids governor. And that whole interaction with Dutch was fabulous because, you know, he picked him up, swept him up on his hip, snuggled him, and then, you know, just didn't miss a beat and kept the speech going. And as any working mom and now a working father who's in a position of power, to be able to pull that off and do it so seamlessly, it shows that kind of visceral connection with kids.
You just used the phrase a kid's governor. What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, it's a lot of different things because children are whole human beings, right? We often in government approach it in silos, right? We think about public education. We think about early childhood education. We think about health. We think about, foster care. And we approach these things in very simplistic, often in very simplistic ways. But to do this right, we actually have to take on the issues around children in a holistic way. And so we've heard this governor talk about things like developmental screenings and investing in childcare and providing preschool for all and, you know, really stepping up as children are transitioning into college. And so there are lots of opportunities to really be a children's governor. And I think we're seeing that in Newsom.
Kathy, how does that overlap into the issues of housing and homelessness? These are not silo social issues, to be sure.
No, absolutely not. And from a housing perspective, if we have a kids governor, that means he's also going to be interested about where children start from. And it is critical if we care about the well-being of our next generation that they have a safe and secure and affordable place to call home from the beginning. Their education and health outcomes are all improved when they have a safe, accessible and affordable place to call home. So we are really excited about this new governor who, starting out from the gate, has talked about establishing a Marshall Plan for affordable housing. And what that conveys is the notion that we have to comprehensively address all aspects of affordable housing if we're going to really make a dent. And we are so excited about the opportunity to begin working on that plan with him. And really, for the first time in a really long time, having the state, both now the legislature and somebody in the governor's office who appreciate and recognize how important affordable housing is to the well-being of our people and our communities and our economy and our environment is really an exciting moment.
David Heitzeman is here, and for you, this is a governor who started the national debate and focus on the rights of people who fall into LGBTQ or a variety of gender descriptions and life experiences. So when Kathy just used the word comprehensive, she's expecting everything to be taken on and looked at. How do you view issues related to the people you work with? Is it comprehensive yet?
I mean, I think that we say it certainly could be, and there's certainly plenty of opportunities. I mean, kids and youth are leading the conversation in California about what an inclusive and equitable future looks like for society. And I think that we would be wise to listen to them and to understand what they need. And that's nowhere more true than for LGBTQ youth.
So let me go directly to the speech, and let's listen to a few of the clips, and we can all weigh in on what was said. When we talk specifically about the achievement gap and kids and early education, here's what he said yesterday in his inaugural address.
An achievement gap in our schools and a readiness gap that holds back millions of our kids. And too many children know the ache of chronic hunger. I have met families in this state who have to improvise where to tuck their babies in at night, making nests out of blankets on the floor or turning dresser drawers into makeshift cradles because they cannot afford a crib. These aren't merely policy problems. They are moral imperatives.
So to you, Kathy, with the Sacramento Housing Alliance, he was speaking your language directly, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Especially talking about the moral imperative when it comes to homelessness, how he talked about that we should not be the crisis that we're facing in homelessness should keep all of us up at night. And having a governor who is willing to address the human tragedy that homelessness is for our communities and people is really important, and the notion that we are going to lead with a moral framework in trying to solve this problem and end homelessness, I think is really critical to coming up to solutions that will be both immediate and to get people off the streets and into some shelter, but also for the long term, that it takes a long-term commitment and dedication to solving the systematic problems that have resulted in where we are today.
Here's another segment of the speech. I think you're going to hear Gavin Newsom laughing at the beginning of the soundbite, even though he's talking about that Marshall Plan for housing. But the reason he's laughing is because by this time, his 2.5-year-old is up on stage and wandering kind of back and forth from the podium back down to see his mom and siblings in the audience. So here goes.
In our home, no one should live in constant fear of eviction or spend their whole paycheck to keep a roof overhead. We're committed to launching a Marshall Plan for affordable housing, and we'll lift up the fight against homelessness from a local matter to a statewide mission.
Samantha, I asked Kathy how she hears the governor in his messages about kids applying. How do you hear the governor in his messages about homelessness applying to your work?
Yeah, what we know is that we have many children across the state facing issues of poverty, trauma, systemic racism, and it has a profound impact on their lives. In California, we have actually the largest achievement gaps in the country. And recent research, the Getting Down to Facts reports, show that achievement gap is actually there the day a child walks into kindergarten. So in fact, we have school readiness gaps. And there is absolutely work that is research-based and has been shown to be effective in other states and nations that we can implement in California to step up for kids. And so, you know, that focus that the governor has is absolutely the right one.
Let me move on to his references to California values and his experience in working with the LGBT community. Here's what the governor said yesterday.
You know, so 15 years ago when I was a new mayor and I heard politicians in Washington sneering at California values and attacking our LGBTQ community, I remember what my father taught me. It's never the wrong time to do the right thing. And that's what we did. In San Francisco, Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin, two women who had been in love for nearly 50 years, had the courage to stand up and say these two most powerful words, "I do."
What did it mean to you, David, and to the people that you work with to hear the governor talk in that way, in that moment?
I mean, it gives me hope that he will have the courage of his convictions, because it may have seemed easy for him to step out in front of television cameras and allow people to get married in San Francisco at that moment in time for what he or folks around him might have thought as just some sort of publicity stunt. But the reality is that a 10-year fight then went underway to ensure that that right was given to everyone across the country. And I'm hopeful that the cultural change that's necessary in our state, that's a much greater challenge than just changing the laws, will be something he's up to take up.
He's saying he wants to be bold. To you, where does that mean taking the challenge? What would be bold in the arena of pursuing rights?
I mean, I think that it really comes down to not just changing laws, but helping to support the cultural change and to ensure that the resources are available to address the disparities in society, whether that be in healthcare for transgender folks or in the prison system or in the jail system, where, you know, there were several bills last year that the governor vetoed that would have created a homeless youth emergency housing project here in Sacramento County. Where it would have required training for teachers in schools on LGBTQ issues and would have required both prisons and local jails to provide access for LGBTQ folks who are for transgender folks who are often set off in isolation to have the same access to programs and services that the general population had. And so if we can take on those things that cost money, and the reasons that the governor vetoed them weren't necessarily philosophical, but it really came down to financial resources. So putting the money behind the philosophy and your beliefs is really, I think, critical.
So we're getting into two interesting areas. One is specifics about what each of your issues are and maybe the budget that's tied to them. The other is this tone of distinction that Governor Jerry Brown was looking at how to manage the state, and perhaps Governor Newsom, in a different way, will be looking more at individuals and their lives and how to manage the people. Kathy, what do you feel that you're getting in terms of any specifics right now? Definitely that tone is different, but he's still got a budget message and a state of the state message. Do you have enough answers at this point?
Well, no, we don't have the specifics. During the campaign, he definitely talked about increasing the amount of funding for low-income housing tax credit program, his support for reestablishing some sort of redevelopment tax increment that would provide funding for local governments to really tackle this program. He talked about linking state transportation funds to cities who are actually meeting their housing needs. So he's talked about a lot of things and emphasized the importance of bringing resources to the table to attack this problem. And so, you know, we're going to have to wait and see what the budget actually says, but we're hopeful that the budget will include proposals for new resources, particularly for subsidizing regulated affordable housing that is both a solution to homelessness, but also will provide relief to those folks who are currently living paycheck to paycheck and who are one missed paycheck away from eviction. So we're hopeful that new resources are going to be brought to bear, and that he's going to use the state's power to both incentivize, but potentially also to enforce the existing state laws that too often too many local governments, when it comes to housing, are not implementing.
That's Kathy Creswell. She's board president of the Sacramento Housing Alliance. Before her, you heard David Heitzdeman. He is executive director of the LGBT Community Center in Sacramento. Also in the studio is Samantha Tran, senior managing director for education policy for Children Now. Samantha, I think on the issue of early childhood education, there has been some front messaging and the idea of putting some funding and programs in place. It does raise the question of one-time efforts versus sustainable efforts. Give me your take on what he's already laid out.
Yeah, I really appreciated the statement yesterday that he made of how over the last 8 years we've built a strong foundation in California, and that it's time to build, you know, to build on that foundation, but to be careful, right? To be thoughtful about how we do that. We don't want to extend services and then rip them away when there's an economic downturn. And so, you know, we've been really pleased. Newsom has brought together a really strong team in Anne O'Leary, who's his chief of staff. She has extensive experience in early learning. A number of other folks are joining the administration. And it's clear that they are thinking about this as a transition path, right? So they're absolutely thinking about some one-time resources to build up the capacity and infrastructure for the early learning space specifically. You know, we can use one-time funding to build out facilities. There are some workforce investments that can be one-time, though that should also be ongoing because you always have a workforce that you're going to need to build their capacity. And then we're going to transition to some of these more expansive goals, for example, universal preschool and providing greater access to childcare and home visiting. So I think they are being very thoughtful about how to blend the finances and be bold.
What about specifics, David? What are you getting? And I do want to raise the issue of healthcare because healthcare has been a focus both in a new law that went into effect this year for foster care, and in other ways, the bigger discussion of access to healthcare for a wide spectrum of people in gender issues.
Sure. And I think this is an area where I haven't heard enough specifics yet about how the LGBTQ community specifically is going to be supported. One of the challenges that we have with this population is that there isn't as much data to support some of the initiatives that we might want to do. And with the upcoming census that is also not going to include questions that identify LGBTQ folks in the population, it's going to take a bold move on the part of the governor to propose things in the budget that are going to dedicate resources to these problems that we know that exists, especially as it relates to access to healthcare. It's one thing to have a right to it. It's another thing to have access to it and have providers that are culturally competent. So we're really going to have to see that bold dedication of resources toward these things that we know are problems, even if we don't have all the data to specifically identify how big the problem is.
Can you give me an example? Is there a particular target that's on your mind for new legislation that you would hope, or old legislation, I guess, that would move farther than it had before?
Sure. So last year, I mentioned a couple of bills that were vetoed by the governor. One of them was to create a homeless youth emergency services project here in Sacramento County. There are currently only four projects in Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, and Santa Clara counties. And as I think everyone in Sacramento is well aware, homelessness is not an issue just for the big city. It's also a huge issue here in Sacramento. And youth homelessness in particular, LGBTQ youth experience homelessness at a significantly higher rate. I mean, 40% of homeless youth identify as LGBTQ. The vast majority of them are people of color. And so these issues are really intersectional from race to class and gender and sexuality and gender orientation. And all of those layers on top of one another require an even greater dedication of resources to lift folks up to a more equitable future.
So I'm going to pick up on what you just said in a couple different ways. David, have you ever met Samantha before, or Kathy, who's on the phone?
You know, I don't think so. We were saying we look familiar to one another, but
we can't place it.
Kathy, have you ever met David or Samantha?
No, I am familiar with David, but no, I have not.
So all three of you are talking today about the overlap of your issues, the clients that you work with, the need for the governor to pay attention. And I think the fact that you haven't met and worked together points out the need for cross-communication at so many different levels.
No, absolutely. I mean, our organization at Children Now, we look at issues from prenatal all the way to college and career. So it means that we're like in 80 different kids coalitions, but those are kids-oriented coalitions, right? So that interconnection with, you know, the different identity issues that children face and how to support them is a direct crossover. Homelessness, housing, you know, broader safety issues. These things are all interconnected. It is, indicative of just how government's set up.
Absolutely. I think that's true. And having worked in the governor's office and worked in the Capitol for 15 years, I understand that the process of government and getting along with everyone inside can be very slow. Sometimes it goes very fast, but to get what you really want and what you really need and know needs to be accomplished is slow. And so I really hope that Governor Newsom seizes the opportunity at this moment in time to plant that flag in the ground out where we need to be, and then, you know, bring all of us together to figure out what the best possible future looks like for California.
I do think, you know, I also worked in government for a long time and was frustrated and sometimes pleased with different administrations' take on bringing different policy issues together. And but it was clear to me working there that we can't be dependent on administrations to really necessarily be setting that tone, because people live beyond and stay beyond a particular administration. So while I am hopeful that this governor will really be about bringing all of the affected interest groups together and policy forces together, I do think you point out that it is important, especially locally and then as we work statewide, that we do work with, and we've tried to reach out with transportation as a housing organization. Mm-hmm. We've reached out to transportation advocates, to equity advocates, but I think we haven't done as much reaching out to children's groups. And we've certainly, in a number of contexts, you know, we're supporting Mutual Housing California, is trying to do Lavender Courtyard, a senior LGBT-friendly affordable housing place,
right,
to really give people a place to feel safe and secure. But I think you're right. We on the ground need to take the initiative on our own to try to reach out. And I certainly hope to, after this conversation today, reach out to both of the other people on the on this conversation and maybe begin a conversation about how we can work together and see how we can help each other achieve each other's objectives.
Well, in our final few minutes, I quickly want you to answer one last question, and that is, what are you worried the governor will not do? And Kathy, I'll start with you on that.
I guess I'm a little worried that that the budget won't match the rhetoric of his lofty goals. That to attack this problem of homelessness and affordability, we need funding that will help us get at some of these core issues. That will get people into shelter and on the path to stable housing. That, you know, you can have a lot of good policy goals, and we need those as well. We need the state to enforce affordable housing laws. We need the state to show the leadership. But we are going to really need the resources that will tackle the affordability crisis for low-income people who are one paycheck away from losing their home. So while we are very confident of his goals and his vision, the only thing we'd be concerned about is he going to be able to find the resources, including general fund resources, that match that bold vision for a Marshall Plan for affordable housing.
All right, that's Kathy Creswell, board president of the Sacramento Housing Alliance. David, I'll go to you next. What are you worried he might not do?
You know, every week I get calls from people here in the most progressive state in the country, calling in desperation about some act of violence or discrimination that has occurred against them. And these things are already all illegal. There's something in law that protects them. But unfortunately, sometimes it is still the government agencies that are sworn to protect them that are committing these acts. And so I really hope that there is the sort of forward-looking vision for a cultural change, and that does come down to resources, but it also comes down to what you say and what you do and how you influence others. To lead the state in a direction that doesn't just have something that is legal on paper or illegal on paper, but really embraces the value of LGBTQ lives, embraces the value of immigrants, of Black folks and brown folks and women and people of minority faith communities, because all of those communities intersect with LGBTQ folks, and we really need that forward-looking inclusivity.
That's David Heitzteman. He is executive director of the Sacramento LGBT Community Center. And Samantha, same question to you. What are you worried that this new governor might not do?
Yeah, it goes back to the earlier point about we can't silo kids, and we really need to think across the whole continuum. So as we've said, we're lauding the governor for the focus on those early years. We know that the brain development's happening at a million neuroconnections a second for a young child under the age of three. Those interactions are literally creating the architecture of the brain. It's absolutely the right place to focus. And then those transitions into college are critical as well. Jerry Brown did a great job trying to reorchestrate our K-12 system with a new finance system, a new accountability system, but there's a lot more work to do, and we know that public education is under-resourced. And so how to balance that, given that it's such a big budget item in the larger budget, how are we going to make sure we adequately fund schools and that we don't lose sight of that in the mix is going to be an important piece of the puzzle.
Samantha Tran is Senior Managing Director for Education Policy with Children Now. Thank you to all three of you for this conversation, and I hope those points of connection happen soon for all of you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
Appreciate it.
You're listening Bye-bye. To Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. In the audience at yesterday's inauguration of Gavin Newsom in Sacramento were former California governors, including Arnold Schwarzenegger and Gray Davis. Each shared with us some of their observations of this transition and time in leadership. So here's Ben Adler's conversation recorded yesterday with Governor Schwarzenegger.
Well, first of all, you're talking about the inaugural day, getting sworn in. I had Gray Davis, Governor Davis, and Governor Wilson come up to me on the day when I was sworn in, and they said, "You enjoy the day, Arnold." I said, "Why do you say that?" And they said, "Because it's going to be the only day when you're really going to be happy." And he said, "From now on, it goes downhill." And I had no idea. I said to myself, "God, this guy is so negative. I mean, one Democrat, one Republican. You cannot even believe how negative people can be." Oh, sure enough, when I got into office, I realized of what they were talking about. Because you do step into this office, and there are an overwhelming amount of problems and challenges. Challenges from the past, challenges in the present, challenges that are coming up in the future and stuff like that. And to me, I always looked at those challenges in a very enthusiastic way, because I felt like anything is possible, because I've seen it in my own career. And so I was totally committed of doing something different than most of the Republicans have done in the past, to reach across the aisle and to work with the Democrats together. I felt like the only action is really when both of the parties work together and get things done. And this is what I was trying to do. And, I had a terrific time, and I was honored that the people elected me, and I was really so happy that I could give something back to my state and to my country that has given me everything that I have.
And then you handed over power to Jerry Brown, who leaves office today with a big surplus instead of a big deficit that he inherited from you. What do you have to say about Governor Brown's time in your office?
Well, I think that he did a terrific job as governor, and I think that he was very fortunate that the economy was in his favor, and that for 8 years we didn't have a recession, because some politicians are fortunate to do that, very few, and then others are not as fortunate, as you know, that when you have a shortfall because of a recession of $20 billion and half of your budget is education, that means you have to take now from education $10 billion. But that does not make any parent happy. It doesn't make any teacher happy, no school principal happy, or anything like that. And then you have to take from from other social programs the other $10 billion. So it is really a struggle. So we have gone through a major, major struggle. And I hope that the state will put together a much larger rainy day fund, a larger one that we had, a larger one that Jerry Brown has now gathered, and he has made a great effort to put it together. His $13 billion or whatever the rainy day fund is. But the $13 billion could be gone within the first year, in no time, because when the economy goes south, then you have sometimes a $20 billion shortfall in revenues, and the $13 billion is not going to be enough the first year. So I think that California has to continue making an effort to gather together and to accumulate a great rainy day fund. But I think that Governor Newsom is a visionary. He's a terrific guy. He has a lot of energy. And what he said today at the inaugural address was right on the money. And I think that what he wants to accomplish and all this stuff, and be inclusive and bring everyone together, and this is a great home for everybody, I think all of this are the right messages.
Are you at all concerned that Newsom might govern more to the left of Jerry Brown? I mean, you and Jerry Brown had your differences, but you both, to some extent, governed from the center for this state.
Well, look, as you know, I'm not a politician that is looking at left, right, middle, and all this kind of stuff. I think it's all nonsense. I think what really is important is that you're a people's servant, a public servant. That Newsom, if it doesn't matter what his approach is, leave this up to him. He's a Democrat. I'm not going to tell him to change parties or anything like that. And so he's going to govern, but the key thing is that he governs for the people. That he's there, a public servant and not a party servant. That is the most important thing. And so I wish him all the best of luck, and I also told him that I will be there 100% supporting him, and if he needs any help, I'm there for him.
And one last question. You are a vocal critic of President Trump, and you're part of a group of New Way Republicans trying to find another vision for that party. Would you ever consider, as some are, starting a new political party, or do you want to rebuild the Republican Party in California from inside the tent?
I think that the way they're going with the New Way is the way to go. I mean, to just, make the party again what it used to be. So I'm not asking for a new way of starting a new party, but to just a new way. Let's go back to the basics and to the old style with, where Teddy Roosevelt was protecting the environment. Ronald Reagan was creating the Air Resources Board in California and wanted to get rid of smog. He was a Republican. Doesn't mean when you're a Republican you shouldn't be, for having a clean environment. I mean, it's a natural thing. So I want them to get back to the normal way and to reach across the aisle, to work together and not to be just there of what is our way, but what is our way, not as Republicans, but our way as Californians, and to serve the people. That is the most important thing. That's what they want them to do.
So that was former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger talking yesterday with CAP Radio's Ben Adler. Last week, I talked with the governor who preceded Schwarzenegger, Gray Davis, and one of our topics was wildfires. Today, in fact, the new governor is going to be in Colfax with emergency response officials. There's going to be an announcement of new executive actions, as they're described, related to the state's wildfire response. And I expect that the topic of infrared cameras will come up because of the comments that Gray Davis made to me when we talked last week. So you're going to hear some of that. I think it's helpful to know that Gray Davis chairs the Southern California Leadership Council. You'll hear him refer to it.
I became aware of a new infrared camera that had been deployed in the southern part of the state in San Diego for about 15 months now. That camera transmits every second to all the fire chiefs in the county, as well as the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. So instantly there's a fire. All fire chiefs can see how robust the flames are. One time the fire chief in San Diego sent every truck he had. The fire was put out in less than 90 minutes. The worst thing that's happened, no lives have been lost. The worst thing that happened is 4,000 acres have been burned. That's the good news. The bad news is those cameras are only deployed in southern Orange County and in San Diego. So I am head of this business council, and I have the academics. These are academics who created this camera at UC San Diego and at Scripps. One of them has moved down to the University of Nevada now. And they briefed this business council that I chair. Edison's CEO was there, and he got together with the academics afterwards. I wasn't at the meeting. He decided to buy 160 cameras. Those are being installed in Orange County. We'll move on to LA. Gavin, here's where Gavin comes in. He wrote the CEO of PG&E. They're about half the state, including Sacramento. And they are going to install 600 cameras. And that will make all the difference in the world. But it will take a while to get those cameras installed. We have about 80 installed. I asked the academics about a week ago, and they thought we'll get to about 300 total by next fall. Well, if there's a way that we can get to 500 total, we'll put out more fires more quickly, save lives, save property. We'll have wildfires, but they're not going to produce anywhere near the damage that they used to produce. So Gavin has been really critical in getting PG&E, which is covers half the state, to make that commitment. I mean, it's $70,000 a camera, but I mean, look at all the liabilities they're facing for the damages in 17 and 18. I mean, you put 600 or 700 cameras up there, you're talking 40, 50 million, not talking 12.3 billion. I've interacted with him on the need to put these cameras, and he totally gets it. And I think you're going to find him employing all the technology that's available to us to help our firefighters and to knock down these fires. This part of the problem is soluble.
And so you heard Governor Davis's reference to UNR. You might have heard on Insight our conversations with Dr. Graham Kent, who is the director of the Nevada Seismological Laboratory and a professor. He has discussed these infrared cameras and some that are being placed in the Tahoe area. And this whole topic of wildfires came up because of former Governor Gray Davis's interest in it, his work with Gavin Newsom on it, and the fact that it became personal for Governor Davis with the campfire in the Paradise area.
My sister-in-law lost her home. My niece lost her home, and she called my wife, Sharon, and said she was going to a gas station. Nobody had said to evacuate, but the sky was looking really bad. And she heard a police officer talking to the gas station attendant saying, "I don't know why people are still hanging around here. This is a disaster about to happen." So she gathers up her family, starts leaving town. By the time she did all that, it was like a parking lot trying to get out of town. And Paradise had decided to limit the roadways through the main part of town to one lane in each direction. So that works well if you want to encourage people to stop and shop. But obviously, if there's, you want to evacuate, that's another matter. So she finally got on the other side of the road and just spoke to us of a really harrowing experience with flames whipping up, within a couple feet of her car. She made it out. I just have such fond memories of Paradise. It is so pretty. And just to think that town is destroyed. If we had cameras up there, there would have been enough warning that the fire would have been far less devastating. Now, there were other wind conditions going on there. I don't want to put a number on it, but we would have saved lives and we would have saved property. And as I say, it's $70,000 to have a camera installed. It's a relatively cheap date given the amount of heartache, human loss, and property damage that has resulted. So, I speak, my family was affected by it. They're alive, but, you know, it'll be a year or a year and a half before anyone can rebuild, because what they don't tell you is, in addition to having to get the permits, a major fire like that, the government has to come in and make sure that the soil is not contaminated. Maybe the gas station, maybe you had some chemicals that interacted with the flames. So that takes about a year to get that done. So you're talking about a year, year and a half before you can even begin to rebuild. So people's lives are on hold. We don't have to continue to have this happen in California, and frankly, we should not allow it to happen.
Again, Governor Newsom and emergency response leaders from across the state of California will be in Colfax this afternoon. There is going to be an announcement about the state's emergency response actions. We will follow this and bring you details this afternoon in All Things Considered. And thanks again to former Governor Gray Davis for his time and the extended conversation. This is Insight on CAP Radio. Listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. These were tough holidays in the area of the Camp Fire in Butte County, California. The heavy rains have since come, and that's adding to the struggle in what is a devastated area around the town of Paradise. CAP Radio reporter Pauline Bartoloni has spent time there over the holidays. She's working on a long-term project following families who have been displaced by the fire, and she's here to share some of her reporting. Hi, Pauline.
Hi, Beth. Good to be here.
It's great to have you back in the studio. I'm so happy to hear your voice back on our air.
Yeah, it's like coming home.
So give me a description of what the area looks like now.
Well, there are some signs of life. Businesses are opening back up. There's some car repair shops. There's convenience stores. There's a supermarket. Over the holidays, they had ice skating and a tree lighting ceremony. And, you know, there's this idea that Paradise was completely leveled, that Paradise is gone. And actually, I've been up there a few times, and that's not really true. There are still homes standing. CAL FIRE estimated that maybe about 90% of the homes had burned down. So there's still, you know, 1 in 10 still standing. And it's completely random, it seems to me, just with an amateur eye, which ones are still standing. You know, you're driving along a main highway and there's a Big O tire on one side of the street. And then the opposite side of the street, there's a completely level property. So it's kind of the way the wind blew and where they carried the burning embers and which structures they hit.
What's happening with residents being able to go back to their property? Some of them even, I think, living on their property. How's that possible?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I have heard of families going back to their homes that are still standing. There's one neighborhood in Megalia just north of Paradise where everybody has Comcast, power, water. It's like nothing happened there. But I interviewed this one woman who bought a trailer for $600, janky looking thing, no heat. And she parked it up in her land in Concow, which is to the east of Paradise, and is living up there by herself. And, you know, it's just a stone's throw away from her devastated property. And I asked her if it was depressing, you know, what carried her through it, how she was able to live up there. And this is what she told me.
I don't know. I grew up here, too. You know, I raised my family here, but it made me self-reliant. And I did a lot of art up here, my art projects, drawings and glasswork and stuff. And just roots, you know, I made roots here. Love it. Love. I'm married to this land like a husband. I am loyal to it. I am, you know, fiercely determined to be here.
So as you can hear, there's this kind of pioneer spirit, frontiersman or frontierswoman mentality, bootstrap mentality that, you know, don't need much to survive. But also there is a tight-knit community there in some of these rural forested areas. She has a neighbor who helps her get water, her food, her family's bringing boxes of food up to her. And her neighbor, Clarence Trustley, just said, you know, we all root for each other here. I'm going to get a mill with whatever money I can find, and we're going to mill her home, And so I asked Clarence if he thought that Barbara Beers could survive the winter, and this is what he told me.
She's not by herself. She's got a whole community of people. Like you've seen, that she gave us a phone call this morning to level out her trailer, and her trailer was level. She didn't level her trailer. Me, another buddy, you know, we take our community and pride of especially take care of the olders. Like when we get our mail, Barb's the first one to get a house. She is one of the oldest people up here that's been up here for a long time, and she has nothing. She doesn't have the money to buy anything. She gets a free house.
Hmm. What he's describing and what you're talking about is remarkable, but they do need some resources or services. What's available, and how are they surviving in some of those bigger needs?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some businesses in the town of Paradise that are reopening, but they're really relying on, you know, FEMA assistance or just giveaways, food giveaways, friends and families visiting them and dropping off food and supplies.
What's the official line about what people are and aren't supposed to do?
Yeah, I mean, excuse me, public officials are kind of in a tight spot with this, a tough spot, because on one hand, they're saying these are hazardous materials. I mean, Barbara Beers is living amongst incinerated appliances, propane tanks, ash. And some of that is, you know, they're compounds that are heavy metals, cancerous materials. They can cause a minimum respiratory illness or, you know, they're linked to cancer. And so they don't want people to go back and live on their properties until the hazardous waste is removed. But at the same time, they know some people don't have anywhere to go. We're in an affordable housing crisis here in California. And so they passed a couple of ordinances kind of setting the parameters under which people can return. So they don't want people to go back to their homes if they have less than 2/3 of an acre in Paradise. And if they live in the outskirts in the Butte County, they can go back if they have an acre or more.
How about people who still have their homes? What's it like for them to be there in the midst of so many who lost so much?
Yeah, I've been talking to one family in Magalia. There's just not a lot of life. They're kind of confined to their home. They can leave their home, but there's not much there. So it's kind of depressing for them to see the loss of their community and their surroundings.
They also have to deal with the ripple effect, for example. What happens now to their homeowner's policy? Because they have an existing home, their life is going on, but so much has been affected by the loss around them.
That's right. I mean, some of the people who still have their homes standing, some people would say they're the lucky ones. But what I'm learning in this reporting process is that nobody was left unscathed and by this disaster. There's one family I'm following, the wife's name, Tamara Camry. They actually have two properties still standing up in Butte County. And I visited their property, barely even smoke damage inside their home. I mean, everything was intact except their deck was burned down in their primary residence. And just last month, they got a letter from their homeowner's insurer that the company was not renewing their policy after this month. So they're kind of kicked to the curb to find a new homeowner's insurer in a really high-risk area for fires. They're probably going to have a lot higher homeowners insurance rate.
Hmm. We've just talked about two examples, but you're following families over a long period of time. What's your goal with this project?
Well, we want to do a series of stories, long-form, in-depth storytelling. It's part of our coverage of people and place and how they recover from disasters, you know, whether that be wildfires, you know, could be a flood or earthquakes. But we are really excited about it because I think you see a lot of headlines, you see a lot of people caught in a moment in time in the recovery process, but we're going to be following the story as they unfold for the next 9 months at least. And that series will air in the fall, but you'll hear their voices beforehand.
Every time we air a conversation like this or related to the school, I hear thank yous from people who say, we're so glad this is still being talked about, that the struggle and the aftermath isn't being left behind in thought as we move on to other topics. Were you met with some gratitude by people that you're there and that you are connecting the outer world with this world?
Yeah, I think it's been mixed. I've been hearing a whole range of emotions. Some people thankful that I'm covering them, and some people who kind of don't want to be bothered because honestly, they have a lot going on in their lives. Their lives are really chaotic. I'm hearing a lot of just anger about feeling out of control in the situation, not having a lot of choices, sadness, confusion. And so sometimes a reporter coming in is not a priority. But I think people really want to convey that there's just an outpouring of support that they're hearing from around the nation and getting gifts and generous donations.
Let me try to squeeze in one last soundbite here. This is from Chris Kirsten, and he's talking about what happens next.
I'm trying to find a place as close to this as possible. We loved it up here, and I've gotten involved with the long-term recovery group to try to think about what can this place be 10 years from now? You know, what is the vision that we can hold collectively and inspire people to bring back a community and an economy in a way that hasn't been seen before? So what's the upside? What's the hope? How do we do something really different with this place and make it something more special than it was before? The town is never going to come back. I mean, look at the devastation around us. I mean, all these people are displaced. Many of them are not going to come back. And so it begs the question, what do we want to create here that invites people to come back?
Inviting people to come back. So he is looking to the future. All right. This is a to be continued, Pauline. And again, so glad to have you back here at CAP Radio.
Thanks, Beth.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.